Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Erika Nesvold, astrophysicist. She's worked as a researcher at NASA Goddard and the Carnegie Institution for Science. We're talking about her new book, Off Earth, Ethical Questions and Quandaries for Living in Outer Space. Erika, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you, Mark.
I really loved this book. I didn't know what to expect. And what happened is you asked a lot of very basic questions. There's some no definite answers about how off-Earth colonies and groups of people, and you don't like to use the word colonies, I know that, are going to survive. And how are they going to deal with certain problems? What brought you to that point to start asking those ethical questions?
Well, I'm an astronomer and really just a lifelong science fiction fan, so I had been thinking about humans living in space for most of my life. And then I got the opportunity when I was working as a postdoc to go out to Silicon Valley for a research program, and I got to meet a lot of people who were working in the private space industry. This was around 2016, so space mining in particular was very much in the news, and so I was very excited. But the more I talked to these people, the more I started to get concerned that they were really focused on the technological problems.
Right.
And definitely on the economical problems of how to do this work. But I felt like they were not just not paying attention to the potential social and human problems, but they were almost dismissive of it. There was very much an attitude of, oh, well, we'll worry about that later, which did not seem right to me. But I also recognized that as, you know, a STEM-trained person, very much math and science is how I was educated, that I didn't have the expertise to think about these problems either. And so that's when I started talking to actual historians and social scientists about how we've dealt with some of these problems here on Earth throughout history and today, and what we can learn about the problems we'll face in space.
What's fascinating, and you take this from the very start, the very basic question is you know, why should we go? What's the reason for that? And one of the phrases that keeps coming up throughout your book is that we need to try to avoid making the mistakes of the past.
Yes.
And talk to me about what that means to you.
Well, one of my concerns, one of my worries, if we just, you know, march ahead and assume that everything's going to be great and utopian in space, my worry is that we're going to waste all of the effort of people who have studied the way that humans hurt each other historically and today, that all of that harm that has happened in the past will just have been wasted on us. History will have been wasted on us because we'll just end up making the same mistakes, when in fact we have an advantage over the people of the past, which is that we have all of human history to learn from. And to learn how to not make the same mistakes ever again. Now, I'm sure, I'm very confident in our ability to make new mistakes. I think humans are very talented at that. I don't think that utopias in space are our future, but we can at least try to come up with some new mistakes to make and just not keep repeating the same horrors of human history over and over again in a new sci-fi environment.
It's fascinating because, as you mentioned, there's this attitude when we go into space, we will all magically become nice.
That's a great.
And you know, it wasn't until I read that in your book that I realized, you know, that's what everybody thinks, despite the fact that we have tons of science fiction films and books to the contrary.
It's true. Science fiction writers have been doing this kind of work longer than humans have been in space. They've been pointing out all of the potential problems we could have run into, but because it's fiction, you know, people have.
Well, I was thinking there's a Sean Connery movie that takes place on a mining moon of some place.
Outland.
And that was all about what you were writing about, the problems that they brought with them.
Yep.
Now, you start out, let's talk about, should we settle space to begin with? Now, settling in space is incredibly costly and very, very dangerous. One of the books you talk about a lot is Robert Zubrin's The Case for Mars. And there's this attitude that space is our destiny. Can you elaborate on that? Because that I find that when I started thinking about it because of your book, I realized that really needs to be examined more deeply.
Yeah, I was really raised on a lot of this kind of narrative, not to date myself too much or the opposite, but Bob Zukin's books and just the general idea of space as our next frontier, you know, Star Trek, the final frontier. There's so many parallels drawn between space and space settlement and people's hopes and dreams for the future in space and manifest destiny, this idea.
Yeah.
In North America, that European settlers had this literally God-given right to take this land and all the resources for our use, and not just a right, but a responsibility to civilize the land and the people there. And once you really start examining the rhetoric around people who are advocating for space settlement, it's amazing how much these same ideas keep coming up. Which is funny because a lot of these people would claim to be very rationalist, very science-based, and yet there's definitely a mythology, almost spirituality, and a destiny-driven argument at the heart of it.
As you write about in the book, it seems like space settlement advocates are trying to actually convert non-believers into the group.
Yes, absolutely.
It has that edge to it.
Yes, yes. You can see certainly a lot of parallels between that kind of space evangelism and religious evangelism. And in fact, I would recommend a book by Mary Jane Rubenstein that came out a little bit after mine called Astrotopia. And she studies religion, but she really digs into this idea of space advocacy as a religion, which is kind of fascinating.
There's also the attitude that space is progress. If we don't grow, we'll stagnate. We need a frontier for continuing innovation. Speaking of Star Trek, the original series, that's exactly what that was about.
Right, yeah. And the other big dominant narrative in space settlement advocacy is this sort of neo-libertarian idea that we have to keep growing. Progress is vital to us both economically and even culturally, that humans need to just keep spreading outwards, which is not necessarily borne up by the evidence. And, of course, this is still something we're debating here on Earth about whether unfettered capitalism is the way to go or whether we're hitting our environmental limits and yep. Think about living more sustainably. And so for some people, space is a solution to that problem because it takes the limits off. We can just keep expanding forever. But I think that there's some excellent arguments to be made in the other direction, that maybe this is a good time for us to think about what is it that is making us think that progress is the only way to have a happy society. And are there ways for us to figure out how to have a thriving civilization, a thriving community within the bounds of its environment, which is true whether we're stuck on a single planet for the rest of our existence or whether you're trying to build a community inside a dome on Mars.
That's
which
right.
is going to have a lot of environmental limits for a long time.
And there's also people who talk about space as survival, that Earth might become inhabitable, so we can't get it together to solve the problems here, so let's go into another place in outer space. And that seems screwed up to me, is if we didn't figure out how to do it here, what's going to be different if we go to another planet?
Yeah, this is definitely present in a lot of science fiction where there's, you know, a giant asteroid heading for us, right? Which is not the case today. All of the threats that we worry about primarily today would be self-inflicted. Nuclear war, of course, for a long time was the primary concern. Today, it's climate change. And so this idea that we need space as a backup to Earth is very common in these arguments. It's all about preserving humanity for the long term, preventing our long-term extinction, which is a very convincing argument. It's very emotional. You know, it's hard to argue against.
Yeah, yeah.
But on the other hand, it also is easy to go from that to thinking, oh, well, we don't need to worry about preserving this planet because there's so many backups out there, when in fact Earth is, even in the midst of climate change, even if climate change gets worse, Earth is by far the nicest place to live and the only place we know we can live long term in all of known space so far.
As you quote somebody in the book, it's Earth is the only place where we can stand outside naked and look at the stars and not have to worry about anything.
Yeah. Yeah, which is a really visceral way of putting it, I think.
So in the end, there could be this argument, and I get this. And I'm like you. I'm one of those people that wanted us to be living on all over the place, outer space. The argument is maybe we should delay. that we're not ready yet.
Yeah, I tried to give voice to those arguments in the book, even though, yeah, I am right there with you. I want the Star Trek future.
Yeah, I mean, who doesn't?
But I think it's worth considering the arguments against it, both the people who say, well, we're not ready, we need to mature as a species, and even the people who say, no, we should never do this, we should only stay on our home planet. Even though I don't agree with that, I think it's important to engage with that argument to try to figure out where they're coming from, and specifically what are their concerns about what we would do to other planets if we were allowed to just, be released out into the universe to do all the potential damage that humans can do. Engaging in those arguments lets us think about, okay, well, if we still think we should be doing this, is there a way we could do it better? Do we need to delay? Do we need to have more consensus, more planning? All good conversations to have.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Erika Nesvold, astrophysicist. She's worked as a researcher at NASA Goddard and the Carnegie Institution for Science, and she's written a really thought-provoking new book, Off Earth, Ethical Questions and Quandaries for Living in Outer Space. Now, the next question you ask, and I want to mention every chapter is a separate question that has three little prologue thought problems. Some, like a long time ago, would be one of them. Another one would be closer in time to now. And then the same problem, probably when we're starting to go in outer space. So why would we go? And you mentioned that our motives for going will determine our methods. So manifest destiny, you mentioned before, but that led to colonialism and the Wild West and is not a good role model at all.
Absolutely. And there are still people who argue that it is a good role model. In particular, there are people who argue, well, colonialism was bad for indigenous people. We can all agree on that. But there's no indigenous life in space that we know about. So what's the problem? But I talked to sociologists and actual indigenous people in this book, and they pointed out some really great counterpoints to that. One of which is that this colonial mindset, the idea related to manifest destiny, that we should just go and gobble up all the resources that we can reach, is not just damaging to indigenous people, but it was also damaging to the environment, extremely damaging to the environment here on Earth. It was harmful to a lot of other people involved in colonialism, like enslaved people, workers who were exploited, women, and all the marginalized people in these societies, because it was driven by greed, and that tends to result in a lot of harm. And so that's why it's worth really thinking about, why are we doing this, and how is the answer to that question going to change the decisions that we make as we run into these problems?
And this is where, as your book progresses, some of the problems start to get really thorny to think about. Like, who gets to go? And how do we choose? And that's where it starts to get worrisome, because when you start to think about a settlement, and that's the word you prefer rather than colonial, a colony, everything, water, air, calories, living space becomes precious. So when you're trying to think about who's going to get to go to this first colony to Mars, is it going to be doctors? Is it going to be dentists? Is it going to be plumbers? What do you think about what's the best choice, and how should we set up choosing?
Yeah, this is one of the most interesting problems in this book to me, partly because it'll be so important in the future when we're trying to make permanent settlements. But it's a question we even ask today, right? We have people in space. They had to be chosen. There's certainly more people on Earth who want to go to space than can go to space. And so,
and you're one of them. You enlisted for the first Mars colony, didn't you?
I have applied to the astronaut program twice, okay. but haven't gotten a call yet.
So how do we choose?
Yeah, and again, that comes back to, well, what are we trying to do here? Are we trying to build a small seed for a future civilization, and our primary goal is to make sure that that initial attempt succeeds and survives. And then you really have to think about these practical questions. So what kind of training do these people need? Do we need to screen for health problems? Do we need to screen for disabilities? Is that actually silly because we're all going to be disabled in some way in space and it's better to just design technology that gets around that and we don't need to worry about screening for disability? And then when you think on the longer term about trying to create a genetically viable population, if you're trying to throw enough people into space that can start reproducing and not have genetic issues, ooh, that really gets thorny because that's so related to arguments that often slide into eugenics and, again, repeat these same kind of mistakes from our past.
You argue that the ability to learn and teach effectively should be one of the major things for all people.
Yeah, so when we're talking about skill sets we need, I think I mentioned, sure, we want doctors and engineers. It'd also probably be handy to have a dentist around. But
I think a plumber is important, too.
Plumbers, absolutely. But I also think that there's no way to make sure that we have sent every possible skill set that we might need.
So you need a doctor/plumber.
Right. So cross-training is super important, and there's a lot of historical lessons that demonstrate that. But ultimately, people who are up there are going to have to learn new skills and going to have to teach new skills to others. And so, yeah, I think learning, the ability to learn and teach quickly is going to be super important.
Right now, it seems like the rich are going to inherit the stars.
That is certainly that shift in the narrative about space settlement is part of what motivated this book. And it seems to have a lot of people concerned, and it's reignited this conversation about what are we doing here?
Yeah.
Are we, it's no longer just a space race between nations that's driven by military posture and nationalism. Now there's this extra profit motive, and it's driven in the news, at least in the media, really driven by this obsession with a few individual billionaires who are, you know, your Jeff Bezos and your Elon Musk, who are certainly in the news and have their companies that they've built because they want to push humans into space while also making quite a lot of money. But there's risks with this kind of motive, too. Certainly on Earth, we've seen that the desire to make money has led to environmental destruction and labor exploitation. And so it's worth asking whether this is actually how we want to do it, whether this is the best motive for humanity as a whole to go into space.
And again, as I mentioned, the questions just keep getting thornier and more interesting as the book proceeds. One of them is, who owns space? Are you going to own, if you're in a Mars colony, are you going to own the land where you're living? Are you going to own the land right around where you're living? Are the companies going to own the land? And that's not a done idea at all.
No, although it is at least something that that I could consult a bunch of space lawyers about, because this is something people have been worrying
about. First of all,
about.
I love the fact that there's space lawyers.
Yeah, you can get degrees in space law these days. And there's a lot of space lawyers working really hard on this question exactly. So it turns out, as I discovered when I was first getting into these ideas, that there was an international treaty, the Outer Space Treaty.
1967, though. It was sort of an idealistic period of time.
Well, but it was also in the midst of the Cold War. So sometimes I think it's a bit of a miracle that it was ratified at all, because Russia or the USSR and the U.S. agreed on things like not to put nuclear weapons into space. And if you think about how differently things could have gone if they hadn't agreed on that, it's kind of scary. But the other thing they agreed on is that there would be no national appropriation of territory in space, which means the U.S. can't go to the moon and plant a flag and say, this is the 51st state. Now, they did go to the moon and plant a flag, and they had to be very clear that that wasn't national appropriation.
Now, there is a moon agreement, too.
Yes, there was a treaty that tried to make this even more specific and say not just nations, but individuals and companies can't claim territory. But the moon agreement failed. There were no spacefaring nations at the time who signed on to it, and so it's generally considered a failed treaty, which means there's still kind of this gray area about, okay, well, the U.S. can't claim the moon, but what if a company goes up there and wants to mine ice off of the South Pole of the moon? Do they own that land? Do they own the ice that they mine, which would let them sell it? And there's been a lot of work by the U.S. and other companies, other countries, to try to create a legal framework that would allow companies to actually own the resources they mine.
Ooh. Well, and this brings into a larger problem, which is, I found fascinating to think about is, you know, we're going into this. Is it just new worlds to exploit and destroy in the search for profitable resources? Or does a planet have some rights? Like here on Earth, and you write about this in the book, there have been rivers, I think it was in New Zealand, which are declared to have sort of a personhood. Is it ethically okay just to go to another planet, say Mars, and just completely devastate it and terraform it?
Yeah, this is a really important question to ask, especially if you think, as I do, that what we do in space is something that all of humanity should have some kind of say in. And as it turns out, there are a lot of cultures, especially non-Western cultures, who understand land and non-human life and even non-living matter as having more intrinsic value, intrinsic rights even, than Western cultures do. And so the more you talk to people who feel that way, the more you realize that the kind of things we want to do in space can be very harmful and even very disrespectful if you have that worldview on the universe. And it's easy to say, well, not only are there no people on Mars, but as far as we know, there's no ecosystem at all, so we don't need to worry about environmental protection. But these landscapes are not only beautiful and pristine, but they've been there longer than we have. And any kind of mining or something much more drastic like terraforming would just permanently change them. And it's worth asking whether that's something we want to do before we make that irreversible decision.
Well, and then it gets more complicated still is, should they be digging and finally discover microscopic life, say? We won't even make it complicated. Just microscopic life that really is indigenous to Mars. What happens then?
Yeah. And this is a question that's still open for Mars in particular. And this is something scientists have been worried about for a while, because one thing the astrobiologists really don't want to happen is they don't want to get up there and discover microbes on Mars and then not be able to tell whether it's actual alien life or something that hitched a ride from Earth on a previous mining vessel, for example. And so there have been guidelines in place, planetary protection guidelines, to try to prevent that by sterilizing spacecraft and things like that. But that'll get harder to enforce as more people start going up there.
Yeah, and there definitely is going to be this rush to consider the planet disposable, a sort of a disposable planet mentality. I can feel it already.
Yeah, that's definitely something you can see. It's not everywhere in the conversation about space settlement, but you can certainly see certain people arguing that we need to go settle space because then we just don't have to worry about this one. Or maybe Earth is the best planet, so we should keep it intact, but in terms of mining, we can just churn through everything we can reach and not worry about preserving it because nobody lives there.
Well, this is where we have to start thinking about becoming an extra-Earth citizen. Like a citizen of the solar system, or the rest of space for that matter. Once we leave this planet, we're taking on other attitudes.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've heard a lot of people working within the space community who are starting to be concerned about environmental protection in space and starting to recognize that even though when we think of the environment and protecting an environment, we usually think of rainforests and pandas and coral reefs, but maybe this environment that's worthy of protection extends far beyond our atmosphere. And we need to think about protecting the moon and even empty places like the orbit of the Earth.
We only have a few minutes left and there's so much more I wanted to talk about. But one of the things that you write extensively about in the book, and this really grabbed my attention, is what happens when somebody commits a crime on, say, the Mars colony? What do we do? People are at a premium. Everybody there has several jobs they need to be doing. And the loss of one person, putting them in, space jail? And who determines that? Who makes that call?
Yeah, this turned out to be a really fascinating question for me, too. So you can start off with, you know, what laws are you even following if you're in a space settlement? And you can go back to things like the Outer Space Treaty. The space lawyers have some things to say about that. But even if you get past that initial part and say, okay, you've all agreed that this person has committed a crime according to whatever laws you're following, then what do you do?
You can't just easily, like send them back to Earth, because that's not going to be that easy to do.
Right, and you can't just banish them from the settlement, because if you kick them out the airlock, that's just the same as a death sentence. And surely no one would agree that executing everyone who commits a crime is a good idea, either practically or morally.
But putting them in some kind of extraterrestrial jail is just using up resources, which are at a premium.
Yep, it's a waste of space. It's a waste of labor. You've lost the labor of the person that you've imprisoned. Maybe you can force them to work, but that is also a recipe for a lot of exploitation. And so that made me start thinking, well, what are the alternatives? And it turns out that there are a lot of alternatives to the prison system.
Which you write about in your book.
That have been used on Earth for generations, because prisons are actually a pretty recent invention. And so maybe we need to look at these alternatives on Earth, see how they might work in space, and then we don't have to worry about building space prisons.
My big takeaway from the book is we need to talk about these things now, not after we've started to settle Mars.
Exactly. There's no, we'll worry about that later.
No, there isn't. My guest tonight is Erika Nesvold, astrophysicist. She's worked as a researcher at NASA Goddard in the Carnegie Institution for Science, and she's written a really thought-provoking book called Off Earth, Ethical Questions and Quandaries for Living in Outer Space. Erika, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.